Three more nights his age.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Wednesday, March 25th. I know first up on our list is House Bill 3044, and I apologize if people are here to testify on that. We're going to carry that bill over until Friday for a public hearing. So with that, committee, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2433. Victoria, would you like to tell us what the bill used to be?
Okay. Since you put it that way, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2433 used to establish factors that the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services might consider when reviewing premium rates for specified health insurance plans, required health insurers to include statement of administrative expense in rate filings, and director to approve any increase effective April 1st, 2010.
And committee, I believe we have amendments on that bill. And to walk us through the amendments and the purpose of that in this particular bill, I'd like to call up Teresa Miller with the Insurance Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the Acting Administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today to testify in support and walk you through the -4 amendments to House Bill 2433, which completely replaced the original bill. These amendments are intended to allow Oregonians who work for or work for small employers and who've lost their jobs to get the full benefit of a new federal program that provides for federal subsidies for health insurance premiums. Under existing law, anyone who has group health insurance through their employer and who loses their job is allowed to continue to keep their group coverage under their employer's plan. If the employer has more than 20 employees, this right is provided under a federal law that most of you probably heard of called COBRA. And for those who worked for a smaller employer, similar rights are provided by a state law called continuation of benefits. Normally, the former employee has to pay the full cost of staying on the employer's group health plan. But these plans are actually typically very expensive, and oftentimes for somebody who's just lost their job, these plans are just not going to be affordable. So to try and provide relief for these individuals, on February 17th of this year, the federal government passed the economic stimulus package, which provides a federal subsidy for health insurance premiums for individuals who've lost their job and qualify for either COBRA or state continuation benefits. Under the economic stimulus package, Oregonians who qualify pay only 35% of their premiums and the cost of continued coverage, and the remaining 65% is paid for by the insurer or the employer, and they are reimbursed for that through their federal payroll taxes. The federal subsidy is available for 9 months, and under COBRA, Oregonians who work for an employer with more than 20 or 20 or more employers, they can keep their health benefits for up to 9 months, and they can take full advantage of the subsidy that's available for 9 months. However, currently, state continuation benefits are only available for 6 months, and that's what the -4 amendments are intended to address. The -4 amendments essentially extend state continuation from 6 months to 9 months and allow Oregonians who qualify to take full advantage of this federal subsidy. The amendment also provides that the department may address additional issues related to the application of the federal stimulus package to Oregon state continuation law through the adoption of emergency rules. And some of the issues that we would anticipate addressing through emergency rules are issues like notification. How do we make sure we notify employers and or employees about this plan and the federal subsidy that's available? And also providing for a second election option. So for people who, before this subsidy became available, decided not to continue on their employer's plan, we would offer them a second chance to take advantage of this opportunity and opt into their employer plan. The -4 amendments to House Bill 2433 will hopefully provide important benefits to Oregonians who are most at no cost to the state. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm more than happy to answer any questions you have. I think these amendments are fairly simple and straightforward, and would urge your support.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions, Representative Widener?
Thank you, Chair Hovey. We do have a fiscal for this?
We do.
Okay, because I was hearing no cost to the state, but when we're extending benefits, I was thinking we might have something minimal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, this is at no cost to the state because it's a federal subsidy. So there's no fiscal to the state from that perspective.
Further questions, Representative Wingard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me, I just have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I assume we have to pass a law in order to make this happen. That's why you're bringing it. Secondly, after 9 months, they are back in the situation that they were in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, what we're doing here under COBRA, because COBRA benefits extend for oftentimes up to 18 months and the federal subsidy is available for 9 months, under COBRA there's no problem with employees who worked for an employer with more than 20 employees. There's no problem with them taking full advantage of that 9 months of subsidy. The problem we're trying to address here is the fact that under the state continuation benefits law, which is similar to COBRA but for the smaller employers, our state continuation benefits law only allows those benefits to continue, and typically they're paid for entirely by the employee, but it only allows those benefits to continue for 6 months. So we would essentially be leaving 3 months of federal subsidy on the table. So this would allow us to take that entire 9 months. But that's all the federal government has allowed for at this point. We have allowed the potential in case Congress decides to extend it. You'll notice in the back that we have that we repeal this in 2012, and the reason we waited that long is in case Congress decides to extend these benefits, it would allow us through rule to then go ahead and extend it and allow that. But at least initially, if you guys give us the ability to extend it from 6 to 9 months and then the ability through rule to do more, then we wouldn't have to come back to allow that to happen.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So just so that I understand, after the 9 months, we're extending it out, but after the 9 months, person is going to have to come up with the full amount themselves in order to continue? Is that the idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, actually the ability to stay on state continuation right now is only 6 months. So, they would, not just would they not have the subsidy, but they would be, right.
All right, one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, please.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I know that there's some, been so preoccupied with state business over the last couple months, I haven't been able to concentrate a lot of attention on the federal stimulus package, but I understand that there are some elements of it that come with strings that require the state to take on certain things that after the federal money runs out may come at a cost to us. So I just want to make sure that what we're doing here doesn't create that situation where once the federal subsidy runs out, we haven't created a benefit that we are now as a state government on the hook for paying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I think I can assure you that that's the case.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
What happened to the original bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, don't worry about that. We are actually working on that. The original bill hasn't gone away for good. You will probably see pieces
that's
of that.
That's what I was afraid of.
We are worried.
We need to talk about the real issue first, Mr. Chair. I didn't think it would be that easy.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for that. Representative Krieger, I know that there is a couple of, I think we had three bills on this insurance rate issue, and so I believe that whatever the committee decides to pass out can be accomplished in one of those vehicles, probably. And this particular vehicle came forward as being something that does have some urgent need and potentially could help people relatively quickly, which is we tried to turn this particular issue around very quickly so that we could get it out there and potentially help some people that might be able to take advantage of this. Okay. So that's why you see this coming back and what appears to be a little bit of a rushed scenario for this committee. Certainly, I would like to move this bill today, but granted, we all haven't had a tremendous amount of time to look at the language specifically, but I think it's a pretty straightforward, simple amendment, but it's certainly up to the committee on what they want to do with that.
Getting all kinds of head nods there.
Let's go. Any other questions for Teresa Miller on this particular issue? Not seeing seeing any other questions. Any other comments? Does anybody have great angst with moving this to work session at this point?
President Wagner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would support moving it and eagerly request that the other ones didn't come back.
Well, I can listen to part of your recommendation anyway. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2433. Was that right?
Yes.
And open a work session on House Bill 2433. Would entertain a motion on the Dash 4 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move that Amendment Dash 4 be appended to 2433.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 4 amendments be adopted into House Bill 2433. Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, the Dash 4 amendments are so adopted. Representative Riley.
I move that House Bill 2433 as amended be passed with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2433 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Cindy, could I have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Helium?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Sway?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holt?
Aye. We could put this on the consent calendar, but I think it might be nice to note this on the floor, so
I'll carry.
Representative Riley, would like to carry, would carry the bill. With that, I'll close work session on House Bill 2433. Next up, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2188. Victoria, would you like to give us a brief summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to. House Bill 2188 prohibits mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, or loan originators from making a negative amortization loan without verifying the borrower's ability to repay. It requires mortgage banker, mortgage broker, or loan originator who advertises and or conducts business in a language other than English to provide certain disclosures in language in which the loan is negotiated. It provides that court may not award attorney fees to mortgage banker or mortgage broker that prevails as a defendant in action brought by borrowers who took action in good faith with specified notice.
Thank you. And first up, could we have Corey Streisinger and David Tapman from the Department of Consumer and Business Services? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee this afternoon. You could state your name for the record and give us some testimony.
Certainly. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I'm happy to be here today to talk a little more about House Bill 2188, which deals with regulation of mortgages. And we gave you quite a bit of information about the mortgage lending industry closer to the beginning of session and some information about this bill. And I just wanted to give you, again, a recap of where what got us to this bill what's in it and why we think it's so important, particularly the climate. This bill did come out of the discussions of the mortgage lending work group that we spent quite a bit of time on over the interim, working closely with consumer groups and with members of the industry. And I'm not going to represent that this bill is a consensus because there was disagreement about these issues, but we got a great deal of, I think, very valuable input from all sides as to what we needed to do to address this problem. And during the discussions of the work group, also the federal government, as I think you know, stepped forward with some fairly significant new regulations on mortgage lending in a response to some of what we've seen at a national level economically. And that also then changed our response to what we need to do at a state level. This bill is part of the result. At a state level, as you know, we regulate mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. Those are exclusively state regulated. They are not subject to federal regulation. Banks and credit unions can be chartered either at the federal level or the state level. They also do some mortgage lending, although less so here in Oregon. And this bill, House Bill 2188, specifically addresses some of the practices of mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. The new federal standards created significantly enhanced disclosures, and that was one of the biggest issues that got a lot of attention. The new federally required disclosures, some of which are in a new federally required good faith estimate, provide clear, plain explanations of key terms about the loan, including whether the interest rate and payment can increase and how much, whether there's negative amortization feature, whether there's a balloon payment, what the different fees and interest rates are. The federal law also imposed a set of more stringent restrictions on some of the loans that had been the most problematic, and that's the subprime loans. So for subprime loans under federal law, there are limits on prepayment penalties. There's a prohibition on making those loans without evaluating the borrower's ability to repay, and there's a requirement to verify income and assets on which the lender relies, and that eliminates for the subprime market the so-called stated income or no-doc loans, which, again, have created quite a bit of a problem that we're seeing in the market today. We think those federal laws went a great deal of distance toward helping solve the problems, but they did leave a couple of gaps, and those gaps are among those we're addressing in House Bill 2188. The first is we think those higher-priced, those subprime mortgages are definitely a significant part of the problem, and the federal regulations do the right thing in addressing them. But there's another set of very high-risk loans that are not fully addressed in the federal restrictions, and that's negative amortization loans. And a negative amortization loan is a loan on which you are paying less than the interest owed, or you have the potential to pay less than the interest owed, so that the principal balance on your loan grows. And people were taking out those loans on the assumption that housing prices could only move in one direction and that the rise in equity would bail them out and they would then refinance into a new loan. And as we all know, that didn't happen. And we're suffering the consequences for that. Negative amortization loans create a significant risk for borrowers. They're very complex, particularly the payment option loans, very complex, and for many borrowers, they're not suitable. So what we're proposing in House Bill 2188 is that those exact same federal standards that apply to subprime loans also apply to negative amortization loans. Doesn't create a new standard, doesn't create a new set of what a lender has to figure out how to do. It just applies those standards that the federal law applies to subprime loans to negative amortization loans as well. The second thing that House Bill 2188 would do is address the fact that in Oregon we have quite a few people who take out mortgages for whom English is not their primary language, and we believe that transparency and disclosure is so important that it should be provided in a way that's understandable. When a lender not only advertises in a language other than English, but also does a significant amount of the communication about the loan in that other language. In other words, the lender is making a positive choice to reach out and approach a non-English-speaking community, is drawing business from that non-English-speaking community. We think the borrowers have the right to have those key disclosures, the good faith estimate, the truth in lending disclosure, in their own language. And we will provide that translation. Now, there have been some issues raised about the fact that these statements are usually completed through the use of loan software, and the software currently makes the documents available in English and, my understanding, is Spanish. But our bill would provide for the documentation to be made available regardless of the language, and for languages like Russian and Vietnamese, which are the next two languages most commonly spoken in Oregon, that would be more of a challenge for the software. We are happy to work with the industry on what might be some practical solutions. We want this bill to work. We are not interested in putting up a standard that won't work. We think it can work, and there's ways to make it work. But we do think that disclosure in the language that the lender has chosen to advertise and negotiate in is very important. The third part of this bill, current law provides quite a few protections to borrowers, and we talked about some of those when I was here doing my overview. There are tough standards that we impose on mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, and most people live up to those standards, and that's what makes Oregon's industry strong. But in some cases, there are problems, and in those cases, often a private right of action may be the borrower's best opportunity to get redress. We have a private right of action in Oregon law today. We're not asking to create one where it doesn't exist today. But that private right of action that exists today has an attorney fees provision that's reciprocal. The prevailing party can get attorney's fees, even if the prevailing party is the lender. And even if the borrower brought that suit in good faith but happened not to prevail. And for a borrower that may not have the most financial resources, having to pay the lender's attorney fees is a huge, huge risk. So what our proposal is, not to remove that completely, but to say that a borrower who is exercising their right to bring a private right of action is not liable for the lender's attorney fees in a couple of situations. First of all, they have to have brought the lawsuit in good faith. That is, if they have brought it in bad faith or for purposes of harassment, they are liable for attorney fees. Secondly, they have to send a notice to the lender in advance telling them that they have a problem and giving the lender an opportunity to settle. If those, and that's the same standard that's in the Federal Truth in Lending Act. If they do those things, if the lawsuit is not brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment, and if that notice is given, we don't think a plaintiff borrower should run the risk of having to pay the lender's attorney fees. And that's the third thing that's in House Bill 2188. I want to address a couple concerns that have been raised about this bill. And one of them is, and you'll hear this phrase a lot, I'm sure, level playing field. We should have a level playing field. All lenders should be subject to the same standard. And this bill applies to mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. It doesn't apply to everybody. In particular, a lot of these loans are made by federal institutions. And that's true. And we can't regulate what federal institutions do. The feds can do that. They should be doing that. They are doing that. If you listen to Secretary Geithner's language, they're going to be doing more of it. But our responsibility is to regulate at the state level. And that's been pretty clear, too. This is our responsibility. And to me, saying because we can't protect all Oregon borrowers, we shouldn't protect any of them, that's the wrong way to go. So the level playing field, if I could make a level playing field that provided good consumer protections across the board, I would do so, and I would recommend that you do so. The fact is our responsibility is these state-licensed mortgage brokers, and we need to do the right thing, in my view. And that, for that reason, we believe that we should go forward with this bill, even though it does not apply to federal institutions. It does not apply to everybody. And I would say, secondly, we've already crossed that bridge. We already regulate mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers very differently than we do other types of lenders, and we've done that for years. There are standards in place for these lenders that are different than the standards in place for other financial institutions. Maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, but we've crossed that bridge, and it's worked well. I haven't seen a shortage of state-chartered mortgage lenders because of different sets of standards, and in some cases, higher sets of standards. A higher set of standards sometimes makes for a good, clean industry, and I think we have a strong industry here. So I think the level playing field argument should not be persuasive in this case. I think these protections are valuable. They will help Oregonians get good loans. They will build us a strong industry, and I urge your support. Mr. Tapman's going to cover the amendment, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Maybe we'll hear the amendment first and then open it up for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, David Tapman. This will be very quick. Your administrator asked if I would touch on the amendments. There are three. One is technical in nature. I'm just going down in the order there on the dash ones. We eliminate the phrase chartered since we don't charter mortgage lenders. Secondly, we've asked that we change the date of the effectiveness of this act to actually January 1, 2010, because that's when the Real Estate Settlement Protections Act amendments will go into effect. So we want to have the two dates coincide. And then third, it was requested, and we agreed to seek this amendment, to change the effective date change the application of the attorney fees provisions to cover any transaction that was subject to a lawsuit brought after the state rather than any transaction that took place after the state. So any lawsuit brought after the state would be subject to these provisions, including the notice provisions that Ms. Dreisinger mentioned. And that's the sum and substance of the amendments as were drafted at our request.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, I think maybe this is covered the last time we talked about this, but you mentioned the languages in the notices, and we talked about three, but in the bill, I think it covers all languages that might be used in the communication with customers, and I want to know how that might be handled.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, what we've said in the bill is that if the lender advertises in a language other than English and negotiates the loan, communicates significantly about the loan in that other language, the documents need to be provided in that language. But the DCBS will provide the translations for the three languages other than English that are most commonly spoken in Oregon, which would be Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese. If, however, a lender does choose to advertise, solicit, and negotiate loans in another language, they would be responsible for the translated documents.
Other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, would you say a little bit more about why you think the federal government left out or has not addressed the negative amortization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that is an excellent question, and I do not know. It's troubling to me because negative amortization loans and payment option loans that have that feature are, I think, among the most high risk. So Mr. Tapman may have more information about that, but to me that's a significant omission, and I have no explanation as to why they chose to leave that out or whether it was brought up in that fashion. The rules, they got vast array of comments on the rules, and they moved quite a bit faster than I think most people were expecting them to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I don't have more to enlighten you on. I know that the issue came up. I still think, as Ms. Dreisinger said, this is the right thing to do for the state of Oregon.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You probably heard there's a new administration in Washington.
I'm away.
And any indication that they're going to address this? Do you have any rumblings about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, not on this specific issue. They have said in very general terms that they believe additional regulation of mortgage lending is needed. They have also been clear that they want state regulators to step up. What form or fashion that the additional regulation will take, I do not know at this point.
Okay. I have one more if it's all right, Mr. Chair.
Hold on.
You know, the second part of this bill on the translation, I'm a little dubious on it, and I just think that it doesn't seem to fit for me. Now, maybe we're just doing an omnibus bill and we need to kind of cover everything efficiently, but it doesn't fit with the other two points to me. You have any comment on that? Is there any chance of taking it out or looking at a different bill, or do you just want to go forward the way it is? It doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, there are obviously three disparate components to this bill. They all deal with mortgage lending. They all deal with problems that we heard about quite a bit in the work group. So, one of the challenges of putting several concepts in a bill, some people may like some people may not like others. We did hear that the non-English speaking population is particularly vulnerable in this area because we do rely heavily on disclosure documents to make sure that people are making their own good choices. I mean, there is responsibility for the borrower here in looking at those documents. One of the reasons to have good disclosure is because we actually expect the borrower to control their own destiny and to make good choices when they have that information. But unfortunately, we heard a number of disturbing stories and about people for whom English isn't their primary language, who weren't able to make good choices because they were told one thing and the documents said another. And, you know, the documents are, I mean, there's this big stack of documents at closing, but in terms of the very basic key provisions of the loan, those should be in the good faith estimate and the TILA. And there was a lot of discussion about more documents, fewer documents, whether translation works. To us, expecting someone to understand the loan that they're signing when the documents aren't in their own language, when the loan has been pitched to them in their own language, that seems fairly important to us, and this is a vulnerable population.
Mr. Chair, David Tapman again. Just to clarify, I'm sure Representative Gilliam recognizes this. What the bill calls for is just two items to be in that second language, and that's the RESPA or good faith estimate and Truth in Lending good faith estimate and the RESPA disclosure. It's not the closing documents that you get. In fact, we know that there's been a bill introduced to address that issue, but it's a separate issue. But all we're doing is saying, look, this one three-page document, as Ms. Dreisinger said, that can be done, we hope, through a computer and submitted to the person, gives them that very fundamental piece of information they get to compare loans so they can make a decision which loan to go with, not all the reams of paper that go into closing.
And
Representative, you want to finish?
If I could, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gilliam, as I said, we really want to make this work, and if it can work through the software, that's the best option. If not, we are happy to sit down with the industry and talk about how to make it work and whether there's a possibility of saying, well, you know, there's the version that you generate through the software, and then there's a photocopied, translated document that sits side by side. I mean, we want borrowers to have the information. We do not want to create huge burdens for lenders.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, David, we've had lots of discussions over this issue. And there's lots of places I appreciate what you're trying to do here because this is the right thing to do, but there's lots of places where I hang up. You know, even the translation into Spanish, because I think there's cultural issues that we're dealing with here. And I don't know how familiar you are with the Hispanic community or how involved you've been in the Hispanic community, but it's something I do know a little bit about since from my wife's heritage and being in Woodburn all the time and doing a lot of business with the Hispanic community. And this isn't going to fix the problem. And I don't know if you realize that or not, but it's they take care of themselves, their own families. There's lots of things that need to be addressed to bring this about, and I think singling out one department or our state banks and mortgage lending institutions on something that's happened over a cultural thing isn't necessarily the right way to go. I think we could be hurting our banks because there's lots of people that do know how to use the negative amortization loans and are familiar with them and want to take advantage of them. And if we put more regulation on them, they're not going to be offered as much. And I don't know if you see that or not when you're putting this together, but I think we're trying to change a culture with a law, and it's not going to work.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I think you're right that it's a multifaceted issue, and the general area of what's sometimes called affinity fraud is a big risk. That is where people are dealing with people that they trust because they're of their own ethnic group or some other affiliation, and that person turns out not to be operating in a straightforward manner. And we have, in fact, been engaged in criminal prosecution involving mortgage fraud perpetrated on the Hispanic community in Woodburn by Spanish-speaking loan officers several years ago. There's no question that this isn't a total answer. We have a multicultural communication program in our department, and we do quite a bit of work with the Spanish-speaking community as well as Vietnamese and Russian-speaking communities in a variety of our programs. And you know, communication is not limited to translating the words. You're absolutely right. But I do think it's a start. I mean, it's for someone who wants to understand the transaction. at least having the ability to see the words, I think is important. We did talk to our director of our multicultural communications program about this, and we do have a lot of publications that are in other languages, and including Spanish publications aimed at home buyers. And she pointed out to me that the number one piece of advice, I mean, there's a whole list of, you know, it's a communication about how to think about home buying and questions to ask and what to think about, but a really key theme all the way through is understand that good faith estimate. But she said it's not available in Spanish. So I understand completely that it's not a full solution. I do think, though, that it's an important step.
Other questions? Corey, real simply, I guess I'm kind of curious about a couple of different items. If the federal government had included the negative amortization loans in their federal rules and regulations that they've come out with, would this bill or would that piece be necessary now at the state level?
Mr. Chair, no. If these restrictions had been placed on negative amortization loans in the federal rules, we wouldn't need to do it at the state level.
So some would argue that we should wait for the federal government to make a decision on this or to do something about it and not intervene. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, is that the state should be stepping up and doing, you know, what they can in this arena when we recognize an issue that is potentially harmful to consumers.
Mr. Chair, what we've heard from the federal regulators loud and clear is that they expect states to be regulating the state-licensed mortgage industry.
Thank you. And one other question about the level playing field as such, you know, because that is an issue that does resurface and, you know, is something that we do want to take into consideration. So if I'm correct, that this bill regulates entities under Chapter 59, and can you speak to a little bit about why it wouldn't regulate outside of Chapter 59?
Well, Mr. Chair, obviously we can't regulate federally chartered banks and credit unions. We are preempted from doing so. One of the major debates throughout the discussion of mortgage lending, starting in the 2007 session, going through the special session in February 2008, and the interim, has been, well, what about state chartered banks and credit unions? Which side of the line do they fall on? Should you regulate them like mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, because they are subject to state regulation, or should you treat them like federal banks and credit unions and not subject them to additional types of state regulation? There's no perfect answer to that. There is no way at the state level, because we're precluded from regulating the federal banks and credit unions, there is no way to have uniform state regulation. We can't solve that puzzle in a way that's perfect. In this bill, we are proposing to regulate the Chapter 59 mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, for a couple of reasons. One of them is with respect to the state licensed mortgage lending. That's where the bulk of it is. And the second one is that under the federal legislation, pretty much they have taken the approach, and I'm thinking now about the bill that's not up today, House Bill 2189, that will deal with loan originators and the standards of conduct for loan originators. They have said they will take responsibility for oversight and regulation of loan originators for banks and credit unions, state and federally chartered, but that states are responsible for those employed by state-licensed mortgage entities. So there's no perfect answer. That's where we've chosen to draw the line. If this committee, of course, wanted to extend these restrictions to banks and credit unions, you could certainly do so. I think in the past couple of sessions, the decision has been not to go that route and to, in fact, focus on the Chapter 59 entities.
So to clarify that a little bit, your understanding the federal government will be regulating the banks and credit unions with, if I heard correctly, the same effective date that is in this bill for the state mortgage?
They will be licensing the loan originators, Mr. Chair, right, that are employed by state banks and credit unions. And when you get to House Bill 2189, which deals with loan originator conduct, you will see that it applies to loan originators who work for state-licensed entities other than banks and credit unions, because those will be under the federal umbrella. But again, there's not a bright line. I'm not going to tell you that there is. We are also seeking the ability to enforce federal standards with respect to all types of state entities that we regulate, including banks and credit unions, in that other bill. So there's not a bright line here. What we're trying to do is make sure that we are taking on our responsibilities as state regulators, and that we're drawing the lines in the places that seem to make the most sense.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment, if I may. As everyone here knows, I'm kind of a policy nerd, and I've enjoyed this bill very much. I think it's genuinely interesting because, in fact, it is three different bills, really. It has three distinct sections. The first one, the third one is least interesting to me, but the first two, the reason why I think it's so interesting is I think they're actually, in many ways, competing interests. Indeed, if you actually kind of extend the theory behind the first part regarding negative amortization loans and the second part regarding the language requirement, really you can almost hear competing philosophies kind of grind against themselves. And I think that actually perhaps is causing some of the angst and tension up here. And that, interestingly enough, Representative Gilliam seemed to be okay with the first part, but then the second part regarding the language component troubled him. I actually, if anything, I am the reverse. To the extent you believe in individual agency and in the power of contracts and people to make knowing decisions, be it including even, for example, and that you believe that they rationally enter into a negative amortization loan, because there could be good reasons for doing so, and to the extent you also believe that they should, that there's a purpose, for example, a truth in lending form, that is essentially establishes that they know precisely what they're entering into, I have a hard time understanding how you can make the argument that it should not be required to be in the language in which the loan itself is negotiated. However, I do think that is somewhat in tension with the first part of this bill. I throw that out there. I'm going to support the bill as is. Thank you for my brief, allowing me, Mr. Chair, my brief philosophical exegesis. But
Mr. Chair, make sure he carries the bill.
I defer to Representative Gilliam, of course.
Thank you. I'm sure you don't want to comment to that. Or maybe you do.
Mr. Chair, I'm very impressed to hear anyone use the word exegesis in a sentence.
I learned it from Corey, Mr. Chair.
I just heard Jesus.
If I had the power, I would prohibit that word.
That's what he was eating snickerdoodles on the way in this morning.
So
inside joke.
Anyway, any other questions? Representative Matthews.
Just for clarification, thank you, Mr. Chair. If the federal government did get involved and active, do the same thing we're doing with this bill, or that your intent is to do with this bill, would they then just reach to the other half of the group that we're not able to reach to the state? Is that what would happen, or would they then overrule everybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, in the regulations that they implemented over the summer, those regulations applied to all lenders, federally and state chartered, because the federal statutes that they are implementing apply to Truth in Lending Act apply to all lenders. That was very helpful because it actually moved us a significant step toward that level playing field uniform standards.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and your clarification on this bill and the amendments. I'm going to call up the next group of witnesses, Sybil Hebb and Brenda Bradley.
Chairwoman, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center here today in support of House Bill 2188. Very much appreciate the time and attention that the committee members have spent on this important issue. We think that the three prongs of additional protection proposed by House Bill 2188 will significantly increase the consumer protection that we have here in Oregon. As you know, we represent low-income Oregonians in many matters, particularly consumer matters, and so this issue is of particular particular importance to us and to our clients. I have here with me today Brenda Bradley, who is a staff attorney in our Hillsborough Office of Legal Aid Services of Oregon. She practices in this arena and participated with me over the summer and during the interim in the mortgage lending workforce discussions, and she's here today to share some specific feedback from our offices about the three additional prongs of protection proposed in House Bill 2188. So I'll turn it over to her with your permission, Chair. Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come here and testify today. For the record, my name is Brenda Bradley, and I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid Services of Oregon. And as Ms. Hepp said, I work in our office in Hillsborough. Previously, I was in our office in Woodburn. And as many of you know, we provide free legal services to low-income people in Oregon. For the past several years, I've mostly been doing consumer law cases. And House Bill 2128 contains three main provisions, as Ms. Streisinger with DCBS has explained to you. And we believe that all three of these provisions will benefit low-income borrowers like our clients. The first is a protection regarding negative amortization loans. And as Ms. Streisinger has explained to you, negative amortization loans, besides being difficult to pronounce, are loans where the borrowers make minimum monthly payments that are insufficient to pay all of the interest that's accruing. And as a result, the principal balance grows over time instead of decreasing. And generally, when the payment increases, or excuse me, when the principal increases to a specified point, then the payment will also increase to be sufficient to pay off the loan over the remaining term of the loan. And as Ms. Streisinger mentioned to you, negative amortization loans are very complex, and our concern is that many borrowers don't understand how they work or the potential consequences of making only the minimum payment. They're risky, and particularly to low-income borrowers like our clients. Often, low-income borrowers might not be able to afford more than the minimum payment, and when the payment resets and increases, they risk losing their home. Furthermore, negative amortization loans are susceptible to abuse because of how complex they are, and we've seen situations where unscrupulous lenders or brokers have misled borrowers by emphasizing the low minimum payments, or often there's also a low initial teaser interest rate associated with these loans that gets emphasized, but the problem is that low initial teaser interest rate doesn't last usually more than a month. And House Bill 2188 would protect low-income borrowers by requiring mortgage brokers to assess the borrower's ability to repay before the loan could be made. And we think this is a fair requirement. As Ms. Streisinger has pointed out, new federal regulations will already require brokers to make the same kind of affordability assessment with regard to other higher-priced loans. And this would require essentially the same affordability assessment that they're already going to be prepared to make for just one additional type of loan product that's been left out by the new federal regulations. The second part of House Bill 2188 is the requirement that key disclosure documents be translated into the borrower's language in certain situations. And before this translation requirement would even apply, there are two prerequisites that would have to be met. The first is that the broker must have advertised or solicited customers in a language other than English. And the second prerequisite that would also have to be met is that the broker have negotiated or offered to negotiate a substantial portion of the loan terms in the same non-English language. And if both prerequisites are met, the broker would then be required to provide translations of two basic disclosure documents that are already required under federal law. We think this translation requirement is a good idea. It would benefit borrowers who speak limited English. Borrowers who do not speak English often rely on oral representations made by loan originators who speak their language.
borrowers who do not speak English are often targets of scams or predatory lending schemes that are basically happen where documents that they sign say something that's different from the oral promises that were made to them. And we believe that if borrowers received key disclosure documents in their language, it might avoid some of these situations by tipping the borrowers off that something was amiss and lead them to shop around and compare different loan products available to them. And we believe that this translation requirement is fair. As I mentioned, it only applies in situations where brokers have made a choice to solicit and negotiate in a non-English language. And brokers have a control over this. And it only applies to a couple of key disclosure documents. And as Ms. Streisinger has mentioned, DCBS will be required to provide model translations of these documents in the three most commonly spoken non-English languages, which will make it easier for most loan originators who are required to provide a translation to comply with this. And finally, House Bill 2188 contains an attorney fee provision that we think will benefit our clients. Low-income borrowers who've been injured by a bad loan often face a number of financial concerns. And under current law, attorney fees are available to any prevailing party. And this means that low-income borrowers who have been injured are often afraid to access the courts, not because they lack meritorious claims, but no claim is ever a sure thing. And a lot of clients express to us the fear that if they were to lose, they'd never be able to pay the broker's attorney fees. House Bill 2188 would remedy this situation by limiting circumstances when mortgage brokers would be able to claim attorney fees. Fees would be available to the prevailing plaintiff, but only to the prevailing defendant in certain circumstances. We think that this is a good idea because it would lessen the barrier to low-income borrowers with meritorious claims. And we think this is also a fair requirement. It would only apply when certain circumstances. First, the claim would have to involve a residential mortgage, and it would have to be a claim that was not brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. And prior to filing in court, the borrower would also be required to send the mortgage broker a certified letter that explains the claim and the relief that they intend to seek. Therefore, we think that this will improve access to justice for low-income borrowers, but also deter frivolous claims and encourage parties to settle outside of or before going to court. And in summary, we think that House Bill 2188 will improve access to justice for low-income borrowers like our clients. And again, I thank you very much for your time and your consideration of this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go back to language. It's still grinding on me. And don't you think, I haven't talked to everybody in this industry, but the ones that I have talked to, and maybe they're the ones we don't need to worry about, are willing to do this. You know, I'm for finding avenues with the carrot, you know, not the stick. Aren't there ways through rule, in your opinion, or ways through communication that we can encourage them to use the software that DCBS may provide? Why do we have to require it in this bill, in your opinion?
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, I think that the principle that the requirement is useful in addressing is the principle of, you know, disclosure and transparency. Hope, you know, if people have information, they haven't been misled, and it's clear and we can show it to them, then they'll make decisions that are good for them. And I think that's a principle that, that the requirement helps us rely on the fact that that disclosure is happening. And I think that, I don't know if there would be authority to have that requirement by rule. I think that the burden on the industry is really not great, and it's also avoidable. If someone says, gee, I really don't feel like messing with these forms, or the translation is too much of a burden, then I simply choose either not to solicit and advertise or not to negotiate the terms of the loan in that language. And if I don't do either one of those things, in other words, both things have to be in place before the requirement would be. So it seems not very hard to comply. So to me, the cost then is far outweighed by the public policy benefit of ensuring that people know what it is they're getting into.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Okay. What about a compromise? Would you, from your point of view, would you consider supporting an amendment that said you're required to provide it in the language in the documents that are provided by the agency? Right now, I think the way the bill reads, it's you're required in any language if you solicit it and so forth. What if we just matched it up and said, okay, if the agency is willing to meet us and say, yep, we'll provide this through software and so forth, then those are the languages you're required. Not, I think it's a little, you get my point.
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, I think I understand your question, and I guess to me, my perspective is that the answer would depend on, I mean, I'm not sure what the DCBS ability to do that would be, but I would imagine, I mean, it seems to me it's fairly easy to translate a form into a language, whether it's Vietnamese or, I mean, Russian or whatever the language might be. It's just one form, and if you're a business that's actually soliciting and advertising and negotiating, then you have some facility in that language, and therefore the translation of the form, which is not very long and has, you know, it doesn't change significantly mm-hmm. over time. So you can have a form that could be Xeroxed, for example, and you just fill in the numbers. So I don't think that it would be that burdensome. I'm open to, you know, how we would make that happen, but I don't think we're talking about a significant amount of work to get that single form translated. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Widener.
Just to stay on the lines of Representative Gilliam here on language, what if we just made it to where everything had to be done in English and you couldn't solicit in other languages?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, we would be concerned about that, of course, cutting out information. And I would imagine the business community might also be concerned if they were not able to solicit and seek out the business of particular communities.
I'm not worried about the business community. I'm worried about doing what's right. So because the other issue we have, there's a lot of false IDs out there that we're getting these loans. What are we doing about that? So because we were issuing a lot of driver's license and a lot of fake social security numbers that were being used for gathering some of this information, and it's going to be the next big thing that we face as a legislature here, and it could be before this committee or a different committee, but there's homes being sold and resold and papers never transferred, and that's going on in the communities.
Well, Chair Holby, Representative Widener, I would say that these, for the purposes of this bill, these are unrelated issues, and we're talking about making sure there's disclosure to people of essential terms and transparency of those terms in these negotiations. So,
not seeing any other questions, thank you very much for your testimony and coming forward this afternoon. I appreciate your perspective and your comments on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
See, next up I have Angela Martin and Matt Wallace. Welcome to the committee this afternoon. If you'd state your name for the record and try to summarize your testimony as much as possible, would it be appreciated. Thank you.
Most certainly. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2188. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. The upheaval in the mortgage market has been widely felt and unfortunately is still evolving and far from over. In Oregon, we are bracing for the next wave of foreclosures as thousands of homeowners receive notice that their monthly payments on their negative amortizing loan is about to skyrocket. The problem is that too many of these homes, homeowners will not be able to afford the new elevated payment precisely because no reasonable assessment of their ability to pay that elevated a payment was ever done to begin with. So we have, again, thousands of homeowners about to see their monthly house payment go up by hundreds, if not $1,000 per month, with absolutely no income available to them to afford that mortgage. This is what's gotten not only individual homeowners into a mess, but our community and our economy into a mess. House Bill 2188 puts forth a pretty straightforward provision. These products would still be available. Someone still could have access to a negative amortizing loan. The lender simply would need to do an evaluation of whether that loan is suitable for the homeowner's income. These are the same provisions that the federal government has extended for subprime borrowers. It only makes sense that we extend those on the state level for the next riskiest group of loans. The other provisions, as we've heard, there are three primary provisions of House Bill 2188. The next I'd like to speak to is the enforcement. In the housing crisis, it's really made us too aware that without adequate enforcement, no amount of laws or rules will guarantee compliance. House Bill 2188 proposes an important improvement to private enforcement, which is the means in which an individual consumer can go before a judge and make the claim that they have been the victim of a violation of the consumer protection laws. Adequate consumer protection starts not with a visit in front of the judge, but with penalties that actually deter bad actors from engaging in that behavior to begin with. When a violation occurs, a homeowner must be able to obtain reasonable recovery. Unfortunately, the law currently acts as a disincentive for the individual to go before that judge and seek enforcement of that violation. Under current law, consumers are allowed to pursue action against some mortgage lenders that have violated the law. However, as we've heard, the risk is simply too great that a consumer seeking redress before that judge may be liable for paying attorney fees for both sides, even when the action was brought in good faith. The potential of having to pay thousands of dollars in attorney fees is not a risk an economically vulnerable consumer can afford to take. Placing an undue risk on a victim seeking justice serves as a deterrent to enforcement, thereby shielding mortgage lenders who break the law. House Bill 2188 provides a borrower would not be liable for the mortgage, banker, or broker's attorney fees if the borrower sends notice that their complaint, notice of their complaint prior to filing a suit, and the lawsuit is not brought in bad faith. We strongly support this provision as a key improvement to Oregon's consumer protection laws. Finally, to speak to the provision regarding providing disclosures in the language that the mortgage was negotiated in. As we've heard, the choice begins with the mortgage lender to advertise, negotiate the terms of this loan, and seek profit from individuals who do not speak English based on their ability to communicate with them directly in the language that the home purchaser utilizes. there's a responsibility that the lender should carry to make sure that the terms of those loans are understood. The federal government recognized the importance of this responsibility by putting in place key disclosures. If we want consumers to stay out of trouble, we need to make them savvy and aware of the terms of their mortgage that they're getting into. House Bill 2188 simply provides a mechanism to allow consumers to understand what they've sat and listened to from the person across the table from them, the language that the loan was negotiated in. I want to thank all of the partners who have brought this forth. A lot of work has gone into this bill. I particularly appreciate the work of Department of Consumer Business Services. I know that they've put months and months into this, so I appreciate their work, and I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Great, sure. For the record, Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with Osberg. Chair Holden, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to come and testify on this important issue before you today. I just want to add a couple of points to the conversation, so I'll keep my written comments brief. By the way, my written comments are also brief. My spoken comments brief. My written comments also reflect our support for House Bill 2189, so just a sneak preview for you there. But definitely, I won't repeat what's already been said. I think that the way the bill has been laid out and the sort of disparate pieces of it and the way they work have been already very well outlined. I'd just like to echo my support, largely for the reasons already outlined by others here today. But there were a couple of things that I wanted to mention. I think that it's important to just reiterate that these are moderate steps in addition to federal regulation that's already, you know, come down the pike. So, for example, of course, you know, the extension to negative amortization loans of just underwriting standards doesn't ban negative amortization loans. It simply says, look, if you're going to give somebody a loan that actually can allow the principal to increase over time while you're making your minimum monthly payments, you should just make sure that folks have the ability to repay that loan. Pretty basic stuff, and not very much farther than what's already happening at the federal level. Additionally, you know, this doesn't deal with everything that could be dealt with at the state or federal level in the world of mortgage lending practices. So, not to, for example, there are a lot of things that still exist in the way that incentives are set up in the mortgage lending marketplace, which I've discussed before this committee before, and other hearings, as well as, the really duties that mortgage brokers and bankers have to the borrowers that they are, ostensibly trying to get the best deal possible for. So there are other things that it doesn't address. These, again, sort of moderate steps forward, and we think that those are definitely warranted. And then finally, just want to reiterate the point that it is, from our viewpoint, very appropriate that states should, you know, take steps forward where possible and states can take action. I think Director Streisinger hit the nail on the head when she said that good regulation really leads to a strong industry, which in many ways that we have, you know, here in the state. And I think an argument could be made that if we'd had similar regulations in place several years ago, we'd have a much healthier mortgage lending and mortgage brokerage industry here in Oregon and across the country than unfortunately in many ways we do today. So I'll leave my spoken comments there, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Appreciate your testimony and weighing in on this particular issue. Thank you very much. And the last person I have signed up is Todd Williams. Good afternoon, Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby. My name is Todd Williams. I own a mortgage brokerage and banking firm here in the state of Oregon, and I am past president and government affairs chair for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers. And Chair Holby and the committee, several of you have heard from me and from us before. Some of you are new to me, and I am new to you. But I will share with you just a couple of sound bites, if you will, before we get started. Understand that myself personally and our firm write residential mortgage loans for a living in this state. We have done so for 25 years. We are the second oldest surviving independent mortgage company in this state. So we've been at this a long, long time through many, many market cycles, both loan product as well as real estate cycles. I first want to thank our department, the Department of Consumer Business Services and the DFCS. We very much enjoy working for them. We think that they do the very best job they can with the tools that they have to regulate our industry, and we try very hard to work with them, and to be perfectly honest with you, I feel very almost sick about the fact that we are not able to come to an agreement and support this piece of legislation that they have brought before you, because we really think that they do, all in all, a very, very good job for Oregon consumers and for our industry in helping make a good, strong industry. One of the reasons that we have one of the stronger real estate markets and significantly lower delinquency rates across every loan product, prime, subprime, non-traditional, or otherwise, compared to other states in our union, goes at least in part, if not a large part, to the fact that we have had this great partnership for a long time. And we are a trade association that has, on every single session but one since 1992, we have come to this body and requested greater levels of regulation for our industry. For a trade association to do that is pretty uncommon. As you know, 2189 was one of the pieces that we were going to talk about, which has been extended. We are in support of that. We are in support of the division's plans there and the SAFE Act. We were large lobbyists in Washington, D.C. for the of that. We've been pushing for those items both on the state and federal level for more than 10 years. We implemented them on the state level in 92 with a great partnership between ourselves and the department. With that said, let me hit a couple of highlights relative to specifically to this bill. Section 2 of this bill applies only to ORS 59 regulated entities, which would be mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, which at the time these products were last available, which is now pushing 2 years ago because of market conditions, accounted for a small portion of the individual firms originating these loans. These loans were predominantly made by three entities: Countrywide, Washington Mutual, and World Savings, which is now owned by Wachovia, which is now owned by Wells Fargo. You can follow that trail if you like. Those three firms represent in excess of 80% of the market nationwide for this product, the negative amortization product. Mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers originated some of that as well, but the vast majority of it was originated directly by retail origination firms from those three companies. When you regulate a minority of the industry for which the consumer sees little difference between getting a loan from me or getting a loan from a loan officer at a Washington Mutual or a Countrywide or World Savings, the loan is the loan is the loan. Secondly, it requires...
A question?
Certainly, Representative
Tomei. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm understanding you correctly, Mr. Williams. So you're saying you don't, your company does not write negative amortization loans.
I did not say that.
Okay.
I did not say that.
All right.
We have written with negative amortization loans dating clear back to 1984.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secondly, requires that mortgage loan originators, the actual loan officer, make an underwriting determination themselves by calculating employment income and ability to pay. Mortgage loan officers or mortgage loan originators are salespeople. If a product exists and a borrower qualifies under the guidelines of that product, and I have that product relationship with that investor, I am legally bound to offer that product to that borrower. So if I do business with Washington Mutual, and if Washington Mutual chooses to have a product available that does not require the verification of employment and income, and that borrower wants that loan, and I don't offer that loan or make it available to that borrower, I'm in violation of federal statute. Secondly, let's talk about the bigger picture. The CSBS, that's the Conference of State Banking Supervisors and American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators, that is two associations for which our department is part of and a great part of, passed guidance on this very issue in 2007 that requires that all supervised entities should be doing these very things. Does it codify it in statute? No, it does not. But it makes it very, very clear what their expectations are going forward. And those expectations apply to all origination channels and all firms. The state of Oregon does not, the department does not have currently the direct ability to enforce that, but it is being enforced on the federal level. Lastly, ORS 59 already provides for a duty of care which can be used to address concerns in this area, which takes me to my next piece. The language is as far as other than English. Our industry and our association 100% support complete transparency and disclosure of all material terms in whatever way is needed to communicate them to the borrower, whether it be a foreign language, whether it be through audio, video, whatever it is. We think consumers should be informed on the choices that they make. They can't enter in a contract and they can't understand and make that decision unless they know what they have. Language barriers are but one important hindrance to borrowers. Many borrowers have issues with math, and we aren't going to hire a math interpreter to calculate the loan that they have. I can tell you personally, having been involved in our trade association and testifying here and been on our ethics committee and reviewing complaints and helping the division with situations, that I personally have seen multiple situations in response to Representative Widener's comment earlier where a member of one ethnic community has preyed on fellow members of their own ethnic community and used language barrier as well as other barriers to their advantage and the borrower's detriment, and we think it is horrible. That's called fraud. The statute already provides for it. The statute already talks about the ability and the act or coercion of an act to steer a borrower and not provide them full transparency of the terms of a loan. Another piece. Let's talk about the language piece. We have no problem in general with helping borrowers understand the terms of their loan and languages and whatever it takes, as I indicated. But these documents are created by loan origination software programs. There are four proprietary programs for the independent community, that's mortgage brokers, bankers, small banks, etc. And there are an unlimited number of systems that are used by larger institutions that have their own proprietary products. The division can have template forms all they want available, but unless they integrate into our systems, we're literally calculating all these documents by hand. And we left that world about 12, 15 years ago. The tolerances, the federal tolerances that go with the Good Faith Estimate and the Truth in Lending Act are very, very precise to the point where in the most egregious situations where an individual is creating an error, the penalty, the federal penalty for certain violations of the Truth in Lending Act and calculation of APR is that the loan for the balance of the life of the loan is provided to the borrower interest-free for 30 years. That is one of the levels of penalty for failure to calculate these documents properly. That's one of the reasons we use computers and calculators for them. To not have these available in the loan origination system software would be a very difficult proposition. So our recommendation or charge to the committee is, and to the department, if they want to have this stuff available through more languages, enforce it through the loan origination software providers, not through the originators of the product itself. I don't write software code. I don't write loan program code. I don't have the ability to do that. Lastly, the piece with regard to legal fees and the private right of action and the inability to have the prevailing party pay. ORS 59 regulates mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. It does not regulate any other financial entity, consumer loans, state chartered banks, state chartered credit unions, investment firms, investment advisory firms, any other financial industry. We are the only one that already has a private right of action even in our statute. That does not exist in any of the other statutes. We're already being held to a greater level of standard through that private right of action. To add another layer of risk to, we're talking about small independent firms, average number of people is 4 or 5, is a much greater burden. I find it not... And interesting, at least as far as I noticed from just observance, every individual to this point that's testified relative to this bill has a law degree and is an attorney by trade. I am not. I write mortgage loans for a living. I understand risk. I pay for insurance for these kinds of things. They're very, very expensive. There are a lot of consumer groups and consumer law groups out there to help disadvantaged consumers if a situation occurs that they've been wronged and they need legal financial help. I'll close with a couple of pieces. The mortgage loan work group for which I was a part of, for which Chair Holby was a part of, for which Representative Gilliam was a part of, I think I covered it, Representative Riley had some involvement in. We made agreement that legislation coming from the group that was approved through the group would apply to all lending channels. This is not the case with this bill. A comment was made earlier about inability to understand the loan product. There is no doubt that a negative amortization loan is like driving a Ferrari compared to a 30-year fixed-rate loan. Anybody who is in the business and understands it knows that it's not your father's Oldsmobile. They're good products for the right people in the right situations. And it's very important that consumers understand them. But two clarifications I would like to make that are very important. For a borrower to say that they don't understand what their payment options are on a negative amortization loan, I find very, very difficult to believe. Because when you get a negative amortization loan, you get a monthly statement on that loan from every single servicer of this product. And that statement looks like a credit card, and it has your minimum required payment and the amount of negative amortization or interest that will be added to your loan if you make that payment, the interest-only payment, a payment fully amortizing as if you are making a 30-year amortization, and a payment fully amortizing as if you are making a 15-year mortgage payment. They're in great big boxes, just like you get on a credit card when you get your monthly Visa statement that says, here's your balance, here's your charges, here's the interest, here's the minimum payment, and here's the payment you would need to make to pay it all in full. They're great big boxes. So while that doesn't address the period of time getting their loan, it sure addresses, once they have it, what their payment options are. Lastly, I appreciate Ms. Martin's comments from our Oregon, but I will publicly say that I challenge her to find me one loan, one negative amortization loan that's been originated in the last 5 to 7 years where that borrower's fully indexed interest rate is higher today than it was when they took out the loan. Not teaser rate, but their fully indexed rate. And I would venture that their payment, even the teaser rate payment, is not dramatically higher than the rates today. One of the things that the Federal Reserve has done, good, bad, or indifferent if you agree with their tactics, is they have dropped interest rates dramatically, especially rate indexes. Most rate indexes were 5 and 6% when the majority of these loans were taken, so the fully indexed rate was 7 or 8%. Those indexes today are between 0 and 2, so the fully indexed rate is between 3 and 5. Those are actually equal to or less than the going fixed rates when those loans went out by a long shot, as well as equal to or lower than today's fixed rates. So there are a lot of people that have these loans today that are awful doggone thankful that they do, because it's helped them be able to make their payments. I will close with those comments.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. May I have a series of questions?
Certainly.
Thank you. So, Mr. Williams, we haven't had a chance to meet before, and maybe you could go through the bill with me and help me understand your problems with the bill. So, do you have the bill in front of you?
I do, ma'am.
Great. So, I understand you do write negative amortization loans, correct?
That is correct.
So, show me the part in Section 2 that would give you heartburn that you're not already doing.
Item 1, it only applies to mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers, which even in the days when these loans were being written, which they
so
are today.
That if it applied to more people, you could live with it, but the fact that it applies to your industry, you have a problem with. Is that correct?
If you're wanting to correct a problem, you don't want to regulate a quarter of people
doing it. Just answer my question, if you would, please.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Thank you. So you're okay with this section. You just have a problem with it not applying to more companies. Is that correct?
Our pieces relative to Section 2 are that. The second piece is, as a mortgage loan originator, which I am by trade, I actually write loans in addition to running the firm, if I have a product available and that person qualifies for it.
Show me the part in the bill that you would have problem with.
A loan officer can't make an underwriting decision, Representative Tomei. That's not their job.
Show me the part in the bill that you have a problem
with. In the bill, it requires
show me the line, if you would, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Section 2, mortgage banker, mortgage broker, or loan originator may not negotiate, make, or offer to negotiate or make a negative amortization loan without regard to the borrower's repayment ability at the time the loan is made.
2-2.
That's line 12, page 2, ma'am.
Line 12.
I'm sorry, I'm not recognizing the chair through this.
Okay.
I apologize.
And your problem with that, again, is?
A loan originator does not make an underwriting decision, and verifying or determining without regard to the borrower's repayment ability
wouldn't
is
someone
making
in your
an
firm do
decision.
That? Wouldn't someone in your firm make that decision?
An underwriter makes that decision.
And someone in your firm?
An underwriter makes
correct?
The decision on the loan, but if I'm brokering that mortgage loan and I'm not banking it myself. I don't make, in fact, on all of our negative amortization loans, nobody in my firm makes that decision.
So
the underwriter
makes that decision?
At the bank
who,
makes
who
the decision.
Who does that study that makes
the underwriter at the
bank. Person can afford
the underwriter in this case at Washington Mutual, World Savings, and Countrywide.
Someone you're in connection with, you know, business-wise, right? So somebody would make this determination whether or not they could repay the loan. Is that correct?
The underwriter, ma'am, who I have no control over.
It's not the underwriter is not somebody you work with?
The underwriter, I have no control over. They work for Countrywide or Washington Mutual or World Savings in the case of the days when these loans are being made, Representative Tomei.
Okay, fine.
And Chair Holby.
Go to the next section you have problems with.
Okay. In Section 2... I do not have a problem with other sections other than Section 2 now, other than the fact that it applies only to us.
Got that. Okay. Do you
so write, those two pieces.
Do you write, do you advertise in languages other than English?
Not at this time, ma'am.
Okay. So you wouldn't have problems with that part of the bill. Is that correct?
My company, personally, I'm not here representing my company.
I'm asking you, your problem. Would you have a problem since you don't advertise in another language? You wouldn't have a problem with that part of the bill, is that correct?
I would have a problem with the part of the bill, yes, ma'am.
Even though you don't advertise in a language other than
I don't currently know.
And so what is your problem with that part of the bill?
My problem with the part of the bill is I don't have the software capability to create the documents.
But if you don't advertise in another language, you don't have to worry about that software.
And Representative Tomei, with all due respect, ma'am, I don't get to make that determination. If I get sued as a result of that, a judge gets
as
to make the determination.
Why would somebody sue you if you didn't advertise in another language?
I don't get to make that determination, ma'am.
You don't need to make what determination?
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
I believe what he's alluding to is that he's representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, not just himself personally as his firm. And I think he's making a statement representing that association.
Is
I
that
don't know
correct?
If that, I don't know if that
I
was...
I thought he was representing himself. I'm sorry. Are you representing another group?
Yes, ma'am, I made that in my initial statement.
Thank you.
Government Affairs Chair for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. You asked me the question, and I ask you, do you want me to answer this at our firm or for our association? And you said, you personally. And I answered your question.
Firm. No. Right.
And that is for my firm, myself and my firm personally.
Right. So your firm personally, since your firm does not advertise right. in a language other
but
than
But many
English.
Of our members do.
Members of the association.
Yes, ma'am.
You personally. Thank you. Any other problems with the bill?
For Section 2 or other sections of
other
the bill?
Other sections.
Yes, ma'am.
For yourself.
Again, I'm here representing the association, ma'am.
I asked for yourself, if you wouldn't mind answering that way.
Okay. The section other than English requires the documents be created through software that does not exist at this time, ma'am.
But you only advertise, you personally only advertise in English, is that correct? So it doesn't really affect you or your firm personally, correct?
Representative, I will refer to my previous comment in that in the all of this legislation is about what happens if there's a problem. If there's a problem and a suit is filed against myself or my firm, I don't get to make the determination of whether or not I was, quote, advertising in another language or not. That is made by a judge or a jury,
okay.
not
Thank
by
you.
Me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will note that, you know, Mr. Williams is representing the position of the Mortgage Professionals, Association of Mortgage Professionals, so whether he personally... you know, takes one position or how it affects him personally may not represent his association. So I just appreciate
Thank
that you're, you know, trying to represent your association. I just want the committee to understand that. So further questions. Representative Krieger.
Do you know what percent of those type of loans of the total approximately are covered are you know issued by your type of the ones that are covered the institutions that are covered compared to those that aren't under this bill?
Chairman, Representative Krieger, I don't have them right here in front of me. The biggest unknown to that is, as I'm sure it's aware to members of the committee, the mortgage brokerage and mortgage banking side of the whole mortgage origination channel has shrunk dramatically, much more so than of the exempt institutions. And so while our industry nationally represented somewhere in the neighborhood of two-thirds of all mortgage loans originated back in 03 and 04, all loans, first, second, subprime, prime, the whole bit, the statistics we're receiving now were more like 25% and falling still. So if you're asking me to get you data on when some of these loans were originated back in 03, 04, 05, I can get you that. I can probably get it for you currently, but the data is going to be dramatically different.
Chair, follow up. In your opinion, just your opinion, I'm trying to understand why the state moved this bill forward and exempted a big portion of it that they had institutions that they had to that they had the authority to regulate the same way, and they're going to be doing the same thing, not under the same regulations. Why did they do that? Do you know?
I do not, Chair Hovey, Representative Krieger. I do not know. I do not know it. But that's obviously their prerogative, and like I said, we respect the department very, very much. We think they do a great job.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, because I know a lot of things are going on at the federal level. And I spoke with the Realtor Association here the other day, or Yamhill County Realtors. It appears... are there regulations on doing a home loan where you have to have like 20% down now and they're starting to tighten things up on you just to even do a loan? Or is that the banks policing themselves at this point?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, in general, I would, and this is my observation as an industry professional.
You don't understand it.
Roughly 50%. Of all the loan product that was available 2 years ago does not exist today. And that's across all you know, A borrowers, fixed rate, adjustable rate, first mortgages, second mortgages, negative, you name it. A significant portion of product is gone, including lower down payment products like you're talking about, mandatory 20% down payments, etc. So a lot of good, ready, willing, able, well-qualified purchasers are unable to buy or refinance homes at this time that easily would have been able to qualify previously. Does that answer your question?
That's what I wanted to get on the record.
Thank you. Todd, just real briefly, I was just curious, you know, as we, you know, have watched this whole process over the last few years, and certainly, you know, it's I guess an issue that you can't really point your finger at any one entity or organization that's to blame for the collapse of our financial markets, but certainly the subprime mortgage market had a lot to do with that, and some would argue that a lack of regulation was, you know, one of the leading causes of that collapse. And so, you know, had the state of Oregon been able to been out in front of that, we could have prevented some of that here in the state. And so I, you know, from my perspective, I'm sort of looking at this issue that, you know, here's a piece, you know, in the negative amortization loans that that we have taken no action on. And so it seems to me that, you know, there is a perspective out there that, you know, would indicate to us that maybe we should be taking action on. I think that's the position the department's bringing forward, you know, to help prevent what has turned into a disaster for our economy from lack of regulation previous in this kind of arena. And so I'm just curious why, you know, when we have that kind of regulation on a good portion of the mortgage lending and loan originator across the country, mm-hmm. now on all these other products, why this one particular product is troublesome for the industry to get your hands around. And I understand your piece that you don't do the underwriting as such, but I mean, I don't know if you can address that for me, because it's something that I guess is ultimately bothering me.
Chair Holby, I can sure try. A couple things, and I've testified before other hearing committees on some of these pieces. First and foremost, I think it's important to understand that, and now you're getting, this is my opinion, the collapse of the residential mortgage industry is a function of not each individual product by itself. Subprime lending is a fine source of product done right. Negative amortization is a fine one done right, etc., etc. What happened was we had tremendous layers and layering of risk going on, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Making a loan to somebody that doesn't have stellar credit isn't in and itself a bad thing, but if you're doing that, you sure better make sure they have greater equity in the property than somebody that has perfect credit and perfect income. Conversely, we've proven statistically that if a borrower has exceptional credit and solid equity in their property, verification of income does not make that loan perform better. We've proven it statistically. But what happens is if you make that same loan to a borrower with good credit and you finance 100% of the property and you don't verify their income, you've added another layer of risk. And that's what happened. The individuals, institutions, national institutions that set underwriting standards, just kept layering risk on layering risk. Specifically with regard to negative amortization loans, it got to the point where negative amortization loans, as long as the borrower had solid credit, because there are very, very few subprime or bad credit NAGAM loans. Very few. If the borrower had good credit, they could just about get anything they wanted in the negative amortization market, because the secondary market was buying anything and everything that had paper and a signature on it. And in order for that merry-go-round to continue, home prices have to continue to appreciate nationwide into perpetuity. And that, obviously, we know doesn't happen. as I indicated before, a negative amortization loan is the Ferrari of residential mortgage lending. It is not a vanilla transaction. And it does need to have additional transparency and maybe some better disclosures. We've reported many times that the primary documents we have to use, the good faith estimate and truth in lending disclosure, are horrible documents. They were created long before a negative amortization loan was ever thought of, or any of the other non-traditional products. But yet the federal government has required that we continue to use those documents and those documents only. And they don't tell the borrower what they need to know. I am a 20-year mortgage professional, and I can look at a good faith estimate and a truth in lending disclosure. And there are things about a negative amortization loan that I can't tell you from looking at those two documents. And this is what I do for them. That's how bad they are. Did I answer your question?
I don't think so.
Would you let me? I'm happy to try.
That's fine. It almost sounds like you were arguing for my point, but I'm not. But anyway, Representative Riley, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a comment, if I may. Todd, I really appreciate you coming and testifying. We need to hear both sides and all sides of every bill that we look at, and I do appreciate you being here and trying to help us with this bill.
Representative Holby, Representative Riley, thank you so very much. I believe very deeply in what we do. We want to help our Oregon consumers every bit as bad as you do.
Thank you, and I don't think I have any argument with that either. I do appreciate your testimony consider your comments very, very sincerely. So I appreciate your testimony today. I'd like to actually have Department of Consumer and Business Services come back up if they might. I'm taking up way longer on this bill than I had scheduled on the agenda. Committee that seems to have gone on for a little bit, but I think this is important testimony. Thank you. I just wanted to follow up a couple of comments that Mr. Williams had made. It prompted me to bring you back up and ask you. You know, he made a comment about the work group, and of course, I was a participant in that work group. But essentially, it was the governor's work group, and I don't recall whether or not there was an agreement of some sort that said that everything that came out of this work group would be consensus, or that it would impact all the players in the industry equally. I just don't recall that. I'm wondering if you could comment on that. And since it was the governor's work group, and this bill is not necessarily a result of that work group, but certainly the subject matter was discussed. So could you comment on that for me?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and for the record, again, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the work group leading into this session, we actually told the work group members following the discussions that led to the bills in February, which were consensus-based, that we did not want to tie the work group's hands to being consensus-only, that we very much valued and thought it was very important to have participation by everyone in the industry and the consumer groups and a wide variety of perspectives, but that we were using the work group really to educate each other, to reach agreement where we could, and then to inform the best bill possible. So we did not, the ground rules, if you will, up front were not that we expected consensus, but that we expected good participation and honest dialogue and a lot of learning, and I think we got that from all parties.
Well, thank you. And then the one other piece that Mr. Williams, mentioned was that their particular organization doesn't do the underwriting, doesn't make the decisions. And so, you know, I'm trying to sort that out as it applies to this bill.
Representative Holvey, the standards that we have put in this bill are the same standards that the federal law applies to everyone in the mortgage business for
high cost or subprime loans. So we are not creating a new set of standards or obligations. What we are saying is that set of standards and obligations should extend to another type of loan product. So it's true that an underwriter decides whether or not to issue the loan, but this does place obligations on the licensed entity under Chapter 59 to engage with the borrower who they are dealing face-to-face with. It does set a standard for them. Again, it's the same standard that the federal government has set for a large category of subprime loans.
And the final question I had jotted down was, and I think you addressed this before, but Representative Krieger brought it up again as to why the state agency would just be looking at this particular group of loan originators under Chapter 59 and no one else. But I think maybe you need to readdress that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Krieger's comment earlier as well. The entities identified by Mr. Williams, Countrywide, Washington Mutual, those are not state-regulated entities. We have no power to address the activities of those entities. They are regulated at the federal level, unfortunately. So we are addressing the state-regulated entities who engage in negative amortization lending, and we do not. I can't give you absolute numbers on this. One of the pieces of the legislation that you passed in the February session was for the first time to actually give us the ability to generate good data on the state-regulated portion of the market, and we do have the first year's worth of those reports, but I want to tell you that it has some flaws. I'll give you the numbers we have, but I'll tell you right up front, these numbers are negative amortization loans originated by these entities, the Chapter 59 entities in Oregon in 2007, but they include also some reverse mortgages, which are a different type of product. So this I will give you these numbers, but I want to acknowledge up front that some of these numbers consist of products that aren't the subject of this bill. In that, the larger category of negative amortization loans in 2007 by Oregon chartered mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, a little under 2,500 loans and approximately $720 million in loans.
Thank you. Representative Matthews?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. You know, and I apologize. I thought I was pretty clear on this, but I have a question of clarification, I guess, now that we're talking. Specifically on page 2, section 2, line 10, and Mr. Williams had kind of talked about this, but it says a mortgage banker, mortgage broker, or loan originator may not negotiate or make or offer a negotiation loan without regard to the borrower's repayment ability, and so on and so forth. I guess my question is, if they're working with these loans with Washington Mutual and banks that are federally insured, are we only able to enforce it on a state agency? So where does it fall into play if, let's say, a state-regulated bank is doing business with a federally insured or federally regulated? Is that going to be problematic for us? Did I confuse you like I'm confused too?
Representative Matthews, there may be some loans which a federally regulated entity is willing to make, but the loan would be made through an Oregon-regulated mortgage broker, and state law would prohibit that without verification of certain documentation. This bill does not prohibit the making of loans. It does set a standard for them.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair? So in that case, they write the loan. It gets carried through Washington Mutual. Let's say, for example, they don't ask those questions about the repayment, but it would still be expected or anticipated that the state license facility would do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, that's correct.
Representative Krieger.
Corey, and I asked Todd a question, and you'd spoken earlier. It kind of goes back and forth, like, yeah, you can regulate them, no, you can't regulate them. Are there any entities that give loans that you could have put under this that you didn't?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, state chartered banks and credit unions.
Why?
First of all, for two reasons. One of them is There is no way to draw a bright line between how whether state chartered banks and credit unions should be categorized with their federal counterparts or state. They have the choice of charter. They could go either way. Secondly, they are subject to a different level of scrutiny already. And thirdly, they have not been heavily engaged in this type of lending in Oregon.
Representative Wagner.
Just one quick follow-up on what Rep. Matthews was saying. So if an underwriter approves the loan, the local mortgage company is still responsible because they're the ones who were communicating with them. So we almost need to move the underwriting to the mortgage department. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we don't need to move the underwriting, but there is a level, there is a standard that we would expect our state chartered institution to meet.
Other questions?
I've got one more, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry you had to come back up, but I did. This was kind of bugging me, Corey. Now, before I ask you this question, I appreciate what Mr. Williams said. He complimented, appropriately so, your department. But he might have had a Freudian slip when he said that he works for you. His industry works for you. But that's not my question. It's the third part, and I hope you understand, I really appreciate what we're trying to do to protect vulnerable folks. Because this is a mess. It's already collapsed. You know, we can't prevent it. We talk about regulation to prevent it. It's collapsed. So we've got people who are hurting. But I am not an attorney, and our attorney is out of the room, thank goodness. And I'll ask him about this. But how can this layer of interpreting what is good faith, bad faith, help folks rather than make it a more confusing and difficult litigation? That's the part that I'm concerned about, that it actually makes it open to more litigation, which they probably don't understand or can't afford. And lastly, I'll finish, because the comment that you made, it kind of bugged me, was you said, what if a litigant happens to have a decision go against them? And my answer to that is, our court of law is where we get decisions. And I've been there. I don't know if you have, but I've been there where it didn't go my way, and it did not seem fair to me. But that was the end of it. So with that, I'll let you comment. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, with respect to the issue of a lawsuit being brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment, that is a standard which exists in a number of other statutes. So we're not creating it out of whole cloth. And it is, I believe, one that courts are familiar with in deciding whether to award attorney fees. Those decisions do have to be made by courts on a regular basis. So generally speaking, we do try to pick standards that are known and familiar in that kind of situation. That's the best answer I think I can give you. With respect to, when you lose, it's over, I agree with that. And we would certainly not expect that if a plaintiff brings a lawsuit and loses, we're not asking the lender to pay their attorney fees in that case. The question is whether they should have to pay the lender's attorney fees. And whether the fear of doing so, the fear of having to do so, would be so overwhelming that it would discourage many important and valuable and legitimate cases where the plaintiff would in fact win, because you won't go forward with something if the possibility of coming out the other way is so severe that it would put you in bankruptcy. It would destroy your financial situation. So that's that's the point that I'm trying to make, that for the plaintiff in deciding to bring a lawsuit, they have to make that calculus up front. And they don't have insurance to pay their attorney fees in the event of litigation if they lose. And again, I'm not saying that it's not a burden on the lender as well. I'm not saying that at all. But it's for that reason that many statutes which are aimed at protection of individual rights do contain an attorney fee provision which operates which is not entirely reciprocal.
That's a good answer. And, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. The only thing I would say, and not really a question, is the other side of that, is what I'm concerned about is it encouraging litigation in other situations, whether you call it frivolous or clever. So that's the other concern. And it doesn't negate your point. It just is the other side, I guess.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, it's again, it's a legitimate point, and the way we've tried to thread that needle is by having that brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. And so that there is, I mean, for someone who decides to do, you know, manipulation and game playing, there is that risk, and there should be that risk. That's why we put that standard in there.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've exhausted the questions for you. It's been a grueling committee hearing on this particular bill.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just make one more comment in response to Representative Krieger, which I appreciate. It's awkward for me to be here explaining why we're not proposing regulation that applies to state charter banks and credit unions, because at different times we have. We've always lost that fight, frankly. The banks and the credit unions have made a persuasive case to the legislature in the past that they should not be engaged in bills like this. And so whether or not they should be is obviously a question for you. We're not taking the position that we would oppose that. What we're saying is we brought forward to you the bill that we thought addressed the problem most directly. Again, there's no perfect solution in these types of situations.
And so since you broached that comment, you know, it's triggered another question.
Or behind, or where I am.
So the question is, we already have regulations over the banking industry and credit unions, and so do you see, and you've already said that you don't see this as a big issue for those industries because they're not really engaged in making these types of loans. So I guess my question is, do you feel like the authority that you have over the credit unions and the banking industry would help you address this issue with them, or?
Mr. Chair, yes, the banks and credit unions are depository institutions, and we are much more heavily engaged with oversight, and they are subject to a whole different set of restrictions about loan quality and asset quality than mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers are. So I think the best way to address it is to say they are different. There are different regulatory structures. We have different powers and authorities, different oversight responsibilities. With respect to banks and credit unions, again, we are coming forward with House Bill 2189 that would extend some ability to enforce federal laws with respect to those entities. But we believe that our banks and credit unions in Oregon are very responsive. Again, I think the majority of the mortgage lending industry is also very responsive to us. We have not seen a problem in these specific areas with respect to our state chartered banks and credit unions.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. That's the last sign up I have for this particular bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2188, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2188. I would entertain a motion on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2188.
Representative Riley moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2188. Discussion? I'm going to discuss it just briefly. This is a very complicated arena that we deal with, and I really have done a lot of thinking about this, and I believe that this is the right policy for this particular bill. I'm confident that the federal government will act hopefully on issues like this coming forward to help us make sure that we don't get in trouble again like we have in the past. And I do have some great concern around the use of these particular mortgage instruments because I think they are very complex and lend themselves to consumers who are not sophisticated getting into them. So with that, that's my discussion. So Could I have a roll call vote on the Dash 1 amendment, please, Cindy?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Nope.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. The Dash 1 amendment, having received the required votes, is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the adoption of House Bill 2188 with due pass recommendations into the floor.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2188 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say, my hope, of course, was that we raised enough questions and discussed it at length that we might hold this over. I respect your reasons for going forward and don't doubt your motive, but I thought there was enough discussion about the three issues that we might hold it over, but that's the end of my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I feel that we had this bill first up in January and had a lot of time to look at this bill, and a lot of discussion has happened outside of this committee on this issue as well, and it seemed like the discussion was not really solving any issues, and it was just a matter of interpretation on what the best policy was. And so I appreciate your comments.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Barton.
If I may, I just think that it's just that Representative Gilliam enjoyed himself so much today that he doesn't want to let this go. I can certainly relate, Representative. So I'm ready to move forward if you are, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair? I'll have to state my piece because I think Representative Gilliam had legitimate concern on this bill and the fact that we're singling out one industry and asking them to basically justify what an underwriter is saying when an underwriter says it's okay and all of a sudden we have state law saying something different. Now they're open and they're liable for a lot of litigation, and I think that's a bad precedence for us to be setting.
Well, Representative Widener, I know you can have that opinion, and I'm moved by the argument that our loan originators are already subject to these same sorts of provisions for many, many other types of loans, and this is just another type of loan in my opinion. So with that, could I have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Winger?
No.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Cowan?
Yes.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2188, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. The due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier for the bill?
I'll carry it, Chair.
Okay. Representative Riley, yeah, thank you. So I would like, I know the committee may have other things to do, but I am going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2199. Could I have up David Tapman with Department of Consumer Business Services? Mr. Tapman, I apologize for the late hour. It took us a while to get through that conversation on the previous bill, but if you'd introduce yourself again for the record, thank you.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for the opportunity to participate and listen to the discussion beforehand. I think we have a number of important issues that are before this committee that will have grave impact on our society, and the last one we just heard does, and I think this one has some similar impact, although probably not to the same level in terms of policy. House Bill 2199 was presented back in February 2nd, 2009, and I testified at that time, and you received written testimony, which presumably you have in your file, or we can make available if necessary. At that time, we discussed how this is somewhat of a broad omnibus bill, and we were covering a number of financial services issues, including such things as the department's authority over bank holding companies, the ability to streamline the licensing process for consumer finance lenders, the ability to bifurcate or split up, I should say, the setting of fees for banks, credit unions, and consumer finance companies into separate rulemaking hearings, and an effort to eliminate some outdated provisions around state-chartered savings and loans, which currently don't exist. At that time, we had a number of people testify, besides myself, representing various financial services industries. And in their testimony, they asked for a number of issues to be modified, and that was the resulting dash ones that I believe you have before you. So I wanted to walk through that just briefly and then address a couple other things, and then, of course, be available for questions. The first issue that came up was we asked in this bill to have the express authority to share with the U.S. Treasury and its subsidiaries confidential information that we obtain through our bank examinations and we may receive from banks such as SARS, suspected activity reports, with the U.S. Treasury's office. And at the time, we just had it broadly stated, U.S. Treasury and subsidiaries. The Oregon Bankers Association asked if we could narrow that down. They were concerned that was way too broad. And the goal really was for us to share with the Financial Crimes Enforcement Center, commonly known as FinCEN. And so we've amended the bill to reflect that we're really asking for authority to share with FinCEN. And you'll see that the first four amendments outlined in dash one, the dash one, do just that. So we're happy to accommodate the Oregon Bankers Association there. The Fifth Amendment was one that was requested by the consumer finance lenders, and that was one where we had originally asked for the authority to set the rate for the upcoming year earlier so that it would allow consumer finance lenders to be able to modify their computer programming going into the new year. At the time the bill was originally adopted, back in 2007, that was, or 2008 I should say, that didn't give us any kind of leeway. So we were asking to modify that, and the consumer finance lenders asked that we address which was the index to be the basis for assessing what the caps, the interest rate caps would be. And they asked for specific language, and we agreed that that would be fine because, as they said, that reflected what they believed was the intention of the original bill from 2008. So that's your amendment on page line 17. It says window primary credit rate. So those are the two amendments that are essentially covered there. The last issue and the most disputatious issue is in sections 34 and 35, where we were asking for express authority over bank holding companies. Now, as you probably recall, bank holding companies are institutions that own outright banks, in this case state chartered banks in Oregon. And section 34 would give us authority to seek administrative actions if there are violations of bank laws or safety and soundness standards by a bank holding company that owns a state chartered bank, Oregon state chartered bank. Section 35 would give us comparable authority to address people who are on the board of directors or executives of that bank holding company. We heard a fair amount of testimony about this, why this was somewhat problematic. I want to just reiterate for this committee that we think this is a very important component of the bill.
It's a fundamental tool that's used in regulation and in bank regulation. In particular, it's axiomatic in my mind that if you have the authority to go out and do an examination, you have to have the corresponding authority to conduct the enforcement and make sure if there are violations, you can respond to those violations. It does no good to put that in an envelope and mail it off to Washington, D.C. Something as basic as the Committee on Bank Supervision out of Basel, Switzerland, which is the international organization that sets standards for all national bank regulation, says that is a fundamental. It's their very first principle of bank regulation, that if you have the ability to examine, you have corresponding ability to enforce. In this current environment, in particular, this economic circumstances that we find ourselves in, where we see banks facing challenges daily in the newspaper and as we go forward with problems, we think this is an important tool to have in our toolbox. You all heard about the AIG problems ad nauseum, how many problems we've heard about AIG. I think what's important to remember, though, it's not AIG subsidiary components that engage in certain regulatory areas that are problematic. In fact, Ms. Miller, Teresa Miller, who testified here in a different matter earlier, I'm sure has come before this committee to tell you, she's the acting administrator of the insurance division, and she will tell you that the subsidiaries of AIG that are engaged in insurance matters are doing fine. They're substantially in compliance. There are no problems financially. It is the holding company that's problematic, and that holding company issue is reflective, I think, of a growing concern that all government regulation has. Holding companies have an inordinate amount of authority over the subsidiaries, and we think it's important that we have the ability to address that. In Oregon, 23 of 33 state banks use this model. They have bank holding companies that own the bank outright. So the vast majority of our banks do that. A Federal Reserve Bank, the FRB as it's known, has authority over bank holding companies under federal law. But it oversees over 5,000 holding companies across the United States. And it's worth noting that it only goes out and does examinations in person at the location of the holding company if a bank that is being held by the holding company is valued at over $1 billion, which for most of our banks in Oregon just is not the case. So we are the ones that would go in and do an examination if it was necessary for those holding companies. And as I say, we have that authority. The other thing to point out about the Federal Reserve Bank is it has multiple responsibilities. This is a small piece of its charge. As you know, they're responsible for monetary policy in the whole United States. They're also responsible for making preferred loans at the various windows. And lastly, they regulate over 900 member banks that are state chartered banks. So they do direct regulation apart from the holding company piece. So for those reasons, we don't think the Federal Reserve Bank is able to handle that full load in a very efficient manner. We've talked with our Federal Reserve counterparts in San Francisco, and they advise us that they would welcome state regulation of bank holding companies as an opportunity to coordinate enforcement if and when that situation would arise, and I'll give you an example of that in a couple minutes. They personally said they didn't see anything burdensome or duplicative of the process and understood that each state needs to determine where they need to be on this type of authority. I believe I've shared with almost every member of this committee information that came out of a request from the hearing we had last February, and that is there are 33 other states that have comparable language that gives them the authority to take administrative action over bank holding companies that hold state charter banks in their respective states. And 23 states have authority to remove bank holding company officers and board directors. This concept is neither radical nor way beyond the pale of bank regulation. Trying to convey that this is pretty mainstream, if you will. Again, given the economic climate, it makes sense that the primary regulator of Oregon chartered banks would have this authority over the bank's holding companies. We were asked about states within our own purview, or I should say within our own region in the Northwest. And we found a number of states in that list that we provided that have similar authority, including what I would deemed to be fairly conservative states around business matters in support of positive business climates, and that would be the states of Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. So we contacted the state of Utah, I happen to know the bank director there, and learned that
in this economic downturn that they have taken a formal action under their authority just as recently as January of 2009, and they've also taken informal authority. And it's worth noting that having this power doesn't mean that every time there's a problem, it results in a formal action. We're just as likely to say, we've got a concern, we want you to address it, can you handle this informally? In fact, that's our preferred method of dealing with situations, but there has to be something to back up that request. I have a copy in my file of a formal action, as I said, that the state of Utah took in January 2009 involving a bank holding company that essentially was requiring its subsidiary bank to pay dividends back up to the parent corporation to cover some of the financial obligations that the parent corporation and its shareholders absorbed when they borrowed money or purchased, had people buy stock and sent the money down to the subsidiary bank. And the order basically just says, and I'm basically quoting from it, that it requires a bank holding company to utilize its financial and managerial resources to ensure that the bank is operated in a safe and sound manner, and to prevent any dividends to be paid from the bank to the bank holding company without prior authority of the department. This is a type of action we feel warrants the type of action that we think is necessary in an enforcement matter for a holding company. As I say, we don't anticipate this coming up very often, and we'd hope we could resolve it informally, but we think that's an important tool, as I've said. Contrary to what others may say, we don't believe this is overly burdensome, but rather it reflects the appropriate relationship that we have currently in this country of dual bank chartering between federal and state agencies, where there are state agencies and federal agencies that share in some of the same oversight. With that, I ask your support for House Bill 2199 as it's been amended by the -1 amendments, and I'd be happy to answer questions of this committee at this time or move on and come back as needed.
Questions from the committee?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Is there a mercy rule in our House rules about how many hours you can force members to listen to bank and mortgage testimony?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I think we passed something like that. It's called bullying.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Mr. Tapman, for your testimony, as always. Nice job. I do have a question, though, and this is reflecting back to the initial testimony we heard back when this bill was first presented. And it was written testimony, so I don't mean to quote you. I'll just mention I've heard from some constituents that believe there will be a cost associated. And in your testimony, it said, believe the concept of proposed language meritorious and in the best interest of public and banks. It would not result in additional cost to banks or additional examinations. We'll continue to examine bank holding companies only for cause. I'm just kind of curious if those are some concerns that came forward to you if in the early phases of this process, or I guess they're being, it's my understanding they feel like they're being held to an additional standard as a holding company, and they're just kind of curious about the costs associated with that, with the two examination process.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, I would stand by what I said. We don't go out and we don't schedule bank holding company examinations unless there's a for cause situation, if something comes to our attention. If we hear there's a problem with a member of the board, and as I mentioned in my testimony before last time, I don't think it was in the writing, we've had that issue come up and where we've talked with the bank and informally asked that somebody no longer be a member of the board. But we won't go in and schedule routine examinations for our 25 banks that have bank holding companies. It's basically unnecessary. And so to the extent that there was a case where we think it came up for cause, we would probably contact our Federal Reserve Bank associates. As far as cost to us, we believe that should this arise, and my hope is, again, it wouldn't arise very often, that's something we can absorb with our current staff and take care of it. There is no fiscal impact to our agency with this.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
But I think their concern is not necessarily as a fiscal on you, and I want to be sure that this wasn't lobby that was coming to me. This was, you know, constituent bank members and directors on the boards. The cost that might be associated with the institutions themselves of having to go through a two-examination process, that's what they're going to get.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, I'll tell you right now, we have the authority to do the exams. We've had it for years, and so if they're not aware of any
impact currently. I don't expect them to see anything any different going forward. I don't anticipate, as I say, routine examinations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just real briefly, you mentioned, you know, in speaking with your federal counterparts and coordination with other states as well, and in looking at bank holding companies specifically. So how does that play out if you for the state of Oregon if you don't have this authority versus the authority that you're seeking in this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, the issue would be that we would be dependent on, one, conducting the examination and not being able to do anything other than refer it down to our Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, and as I believe I said earlier, that then gets sent to sent to Washington, D.C. I confirmed that with our members in San Francisco. There, it gets put on an agenda, and it's determined whether they're going to look at this as an enforcement matter, and then they may correspond back to San Francisco and send somebody up from San Francisco to take a look at it, and then if they decide to do something in terms of an enforcement itself, if you will, administrative action or cease and desist order, they send it back to Washington, D.C. What I'm driving at is it would eat up a considerable amount of time, and if it was something that was critical, and we're seeing this angst right now, are facing a lot of challenges in terms of capitalization and the like. And so if we felt like somebody was paying out dividends that they really can't afford out of their capital to their parent bank holding company, by the time the Federal Reserve Board got involved, or the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco got to the point where they said stop that, it could be detrimental to the subsidiary bank.
Thank you. Other questions? I appreciate your testimony. Next up, I have Tim Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Banking Association. And with all due respect to Representative Wingard, we probably are going to be here for a few more minutes. I apologize for that. As you know, we did testify on this bill when you had your first hearing in January. What's being passed out is R-3 amendments, which you'll note are dated today. I literally picked them up right after your committee started from the office that requested them. So I apologize for not getting them to you earlier, but they are hot off the press, as they say. I'd like to make a couple of points. First of all, thanking DCBS. We do support the -1 amendments. They did include the recommended changes that we suggested, so I do appreciate that. And I think that kind of demonstrates that this bill truly is, for most part, housekeeping. Until you get to the sections that we disagree on, and that, of course, is the regulation of bank holding companies. We simply disagree that is way beyond a housekeeping piece. Wish they would have introduced it as a freestanding bill. They chose not to, and so we now have to come to you to make a final decision on whether or not that section is included, or those sections are included in the bill. You'll see in our amendments that's all we do. We take a 42-page bill and turn it into a 40-page bill. I'm struck now that I've heard the department testify twice. I've still not heard a single example in Oregon of a problem that they're trying to fix. Not one. They mentioned Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah. Certainly great states in their own right. Two states they didn't mention because they couldn't was Washington and California, our neighbors to the north and south. Neither one of them have the powers that they propose to get in this bill. We wonder why that is. We also would suggest to you, as a strong supporter of the dual charter system, you had a little bit of discussion of that on your last bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that. But there is a strong system of dual charter banking system in this country, federal and state. Banks do have choices. I think that's one of the things that the director of DCBS was saying on your prior bill. They do decide where they're going to be chartered. Are they going to be chartered in the state, or are they going to be chartered at the federal level? And some of our smaller banks, believe it or not, have chosen the federal charter over the state charter. I will tell you that as banks are forming now in this day and age, they look very carefully in making that decision, and it is a very strong business decision to choose whether it's a state or federal charter. So again, Washington, California, neither one of these states have the powers that they're suggesting under this bill. We certainly agree with them that this is a fundamental tool, that there ought to be somebody that's looking at the holding company. That's occurring now at the Federal Reserve. If I heard Mr. Tapman right, he said unless you're over $1 billion, you're not automatically examined at the holding company level. But I also heard him say, I thought, that if this bill were to go forward, he wouldn't examine at the state level either unless he saw there was a problem. So again, I'm not sure what extra protection Oregonians are getting under this bill. As I say, we believe that the Federal Reserve is doing a good job in this area. I'm going to actually give you not a Utah example, but an Oregon example here in a few minutes, which I'm sorry that I have to give, given the current situation, but it's a very local bank that we need to talk about. And I would also say that the Federal Reserve and their holding company authority also, there also applies to banks that are examined under the Comptroller of the Currency or FDIC. So neither one of them have the authority that the state is asking for our state chartered banks. I commend the department. I think Corey said it well again today, that community banks were not the cause of what's going on in this country. I don't think anybody would suggest that Oregon banks were leading the charge down the financial situation and the economic situation we find ourselves in. And I'm really frustrated when AIG, I'm sure everybody on the committee knows this, but I feel important to get on the record. AIG is not a bank. It's not a bank. It doesn't operate under a bank holding company. It operates under a financial holding company. That's not what Oregon banks are operating under. Bank holding companies as allowed by Oregon law. So it's frustrating when I hear Oregon's community banks kind of painted with this broad brush and suggest that what's happening at the federal level is something that we ought to concern ourselves and be prepared to deal with. So the example I would like to give you is a bank up in, well, let's just say it's an Oregon bank, and Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'd rather not put the name of the bank on the record. I'd be happy to visit with any member of the committee and walk them through what happened. But the long and short of it is that in the last month or so, a cease and desist order was given to them by the department, which is one of the strongest items they can take on a bank as far as regulating them and as far as trying to make sure they're healthy. That brought the Federal Reserve, because they do operate under a holding company structure, and within a very brief period of time, the bank, the Federal Reserve, and the Department of Consumer and Business Services entered into an agreement that lays out what the holding company can and cannot do going forward, how that information is going to be reported, and I think solves exactly the problem that the department is concerned about. So it didn't take months, it didn't take weeks. This is not a billion-dollar bank. This is a fairly small Oregon institution. So again, we believe that 34 and 35, the sections that deal with the holding company supervision, are really they're a solution searching for a problem. We simply don't see the problem there. And again, we would respectfully ask that the Dash 3 amendments be adopted into the bill. With that, it is late. I could go on, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one. You said a very short period of time. Can you tell me how long?
Well, my understanding, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, my understanding is certainly within 30 days, maybe shorter than that. It was very quickly.
Other questions for Mr. Martinez? Mr. Martinez, I appreciate your coming forward and I appreciate your testimony. I do have to comment, though, because it seems to be something that is happening quite often that, this bill was first heard in January and it's been posted for more than a week. And to get a set of amendments on the work session day,
you know, or any submissions on work session day, you know, without the committee having a prior look at it is sometimes troubling, albeit, you know, I recognize that legislative council is backed up and as usual, and it takes a while to get things out, but it's extremely nice to get these things ahead of time. And unfortunately, were I to move this to work session, the amendments, the dash three that you submitted, I could not entertain them by rule. You know, notwithstanding that, I want to make sure that this committee has the ability to look at and consider those. So I'm not going to move this bill to work session at this point because the required time to consider your dash three amendments has not come yet. So I say that just as a caveat, you know, to try to get amendments presented to the committee administrator by, as is required by the rules, you know, so the committee can entertain these things ahead of time would be very helpful. And that kind of goes with just about everything that gets submitted to the committee, especially when we're coming up to a work session. It's very helpful for us and able for us to move forward a little bit quicker, you know, when we're able to consider this earlier. It would be very helpful. So with that, I'm not seeing any other questions, and I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. And I intend on carrying over House Bill 2199 till Friday. I'm going to also carry over House Bill 3044. And 2189. And 2658. Committee, thank you. With that, I will adjourn the House Consumer Protection Committee. Huh?